All right, you guys, welcome to the show. How are you doing? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Trevor Tim from The Guardian and the Freedom of the Press Foundation. He's going to be on to talk about, the Wall Street Journal story and some other issues as well. And our good friend William Norman Grigg is also going to be back on the show today to talk about the Jesse Trinidou case, a.k.a. the Oklahoma City bombing case and recent developments. I'll go ahead and make my correction right now so I don't have to ruin Will Grigg's interview with it. Yesterday, in discussing the Oklahoma City bombing on the show and the Trinidou thing, I read to you an email from the tampered witness explaining how he was tampered with, part of the story. Well, Will Grigg had more of the story. And one thing that I got explicitly wrong was at the part where he says, and no one ever threatened me, I mistakenly thought that no one ever said that he was threatened, but just that he was tampered with, and here's plenty of evidence he was tampered with. Well, actually, that's not true, according to Will Grigg, and man, I just can't keep it straight. The Jesse Trinidou story comes in such small bits and pieces over such a long period of time. I suck. I don't know. Anyway, I think I already knew this, but had forgotten something. Will Grigg reminds me that Roger Charles and Jesse Trinidou both say that their FBI witness did say that he was threatened by the FBI, that he'd better not, or else I don't know exactly what. So I had that part wrong when I said, yeah, well, nobody ever said that. Oh, yeah, no, apparently they did say that. But in his denial that he ever said he was threatened, he still describes the FBI agent talking him out of showing up in court to be Trinidou's witness anyway. Which, boy, if I was judge, it's not Wallops. I thought it was Wallops. It's Wadups. I should have knew better than that, too. If I was the judge, I don't know. Apparently, this judge does have a lot of fun not putting up with the FBI's nonsense over years of this. So, you know, I don't know. A federal district court judge way out there in Utah. There's news about it. You can read it in the frontline section on antiwar.com. There's a write-up in the Salt Lake Tribune, Salt Lake City Tribune, or whatever it is. Anyway, and of course, Will Grigg is on the case there over at Pro Libertate. So, so we'll be talking with him about that. It's such a huge story. Very important to me still. Can you imagine? Even imagine the possibility for a minute. That really they got away with just pinning it on McVeigh and his buddy that was all sides agree two states away at the time and that was it? No one else did it, huh? Does that even sound plausible on its face? Nah. But that they were able to get the entire media, the entire political establishment, and the entire political establishment in Oklahoma, virtually the entire federal police establishment. Everybody, just go along with this. And meanwhile, if you read bits and pieces in the Dallas Morning News here, or the Associated Press there, or the Rocky Mountain News over yonder, then you might have found out that, wow, there's really a lot more to this story. You know, I single those sources out as very mainstream, easily accessible, accidentally accessible, news sources for this. Huh, turns out the ATF had an informant inside the FBI's plan to bomb the Oklahoma City building, huh? Well, the FBI informant's plan. I don't know. Anyway, the story's been told for a long, long time, the true story. The interest in it just ain't there. And before September 11th, Oklahoma City was September 11th. It was a big, huge, incredible thing. 169 people slaughtered, including a bunch of little kids in the daycare. And it was just an absolute traumatic shock to the American people in 100 ways. And then give them the best case, the most charitable interpretation, the absolute most charitable interpretation that excludes all kinds of things that we know to be true. The nicest way you could possibly spin it. If someone's twisting your arm behind your back and making you could say, well, They really wanted to be sure that they convicted McVay no matter what. That son of a bitch. He had to be, you know, executed. He deserved it the most out of all of them. And if they went digging up the whole truth, it could have jeopardized the case against him. Well, still, that's absolutely unconscionable. I mean, that's the absolute best case scenario and for the cover-up, and it's not good enough by a million miles. Not by a million miles. You know, let people guilty in a plot to kill 170 people go free just to make sure you get one guy? And that's the way they phrase it. And in the book, Oklahoma City, by Gumbel and Charles, they have the direct quotations from the people in the Department of Justice. That's their spin on it. Well, you know, we just wanted to not make sure and not jeopardize the case at all. Really. That's your story and you're sticking to it, huh? It wasn't that all his friends were flip state's witnesses and undercover informants. Okay. Anyway. What a mess. What a mess America is that could happen. That any combination of men could have carried out that attack and that any of them could have gotten away with it. Are you kidding me? Something's amiss. Little kernels of truth here and there, but nobody telling the whole story. Remember, Dan Rather broke the story, got McVay's execution delayed for 3 months when he interviewed Rick Ojeda, who I interviewed him myself. Rick Ojeda, the former FBI agent, who said, listen, man, I did work on the Oklahoma bombing that I know that the work I did was never turned over to the defense. There must be piles of documents somewhere. And he had two other FBI agents with him. And then when they ended up getting, oh, well, here's more documents, then they admitted it. Oh, here's a bunch more documents we never turned over to the defense. It still didn't include all the stuff about Elohim City and the neo-Nazis and their relationship with McVay. I mean, come on. Anyway, I don't want to talk about it anymore because I'm about to start getting into new things I learned in Will Grigg's article today, and I'm going to go ahead and hold my fire and let Will Grigg tell you. And the reason I have not been interviewing Jesse Trenadue, who I have interviewed many times over the years, and who I consider, you know, some kind of acquaintance or whatever, not outright, like, real friends. I should send him Christmas cards and stuff. He's a good guy. I know him, I guess I could say. The reason I'm not interviewing him is because he's in the middle of this court case, and you know what? He's just going to not do media right now, I think, other than talking to a local newspaper or whatever. So that's fine with me. Just as long as I get to interview him with it when it's over. I don't care if he talks with other people, really. Anyway. And by the way, if you were thinking to yourself, what is this about the Oklahoma bombing that Horton is blabbling on about? I'll tell you what you do. You don't even have to have a Twitter account. Just go to twitter.com/ScottHortonShow and page down there a little bit. It'll show you all the embedded videos of any links that I tweet out of a video. It'll have it embedded there, the YouTube. And just go to twitter.com/ScottHortonShow, page down a little bit, and you'll see an hour-long speech by Jesse Trenadue explaining how he got into this crazy mess. The feds murdered his brother, and ended up it was mistaken identity, and they mistook him for an Oklahoma bomber. Oops. And so the murder of this innocent guy leads his brother, the lawyer, to this, you know, 15-year odyssey of suing and learning more of the truth of what happened behind the Oklahoma City bombing. It's an incredible story, and I got the mother load of the legal documents myself, you know. I have a page somewhere that has most of the documents, working on it, but anyway, you can read about it, Mother Jones, too, if you think this is like a right-wing John Birch sounding conspiracy theory or that kind of thing. You can read James Ridgway in Mother Jones magazine all about it, too. It's the exact same story. He gets it right, absolutely. Does a great job on it there. Anyway, more news on the other side of this thing here. you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome to the show. Back to it, I mean. More on the Oklahoma bombing with Will Grigg later on in the show. Join up the chat room. I like having good questions in the chat room, man. ScottHorton.org/chat. I'll either answer them out loud or I'll answer them during the break, or it depends on the situation and your timing and mine. I got so much to cover for you today. I guess let me just get right to this George Bush, because the clip is long and then I got a lot to rant about. George Bush interviewed by National Public Radio, and I think rather than pausing it over and over again to complain, I'm going to hold my complaints until the end, but I do have much to complain about here. This guy, it's amazing that this guy was ever the leader of anything.
The American Israel Public Affairs Committee from...
Oh no, where's that coming from? American Israel. Oh, I know. Oops, sorry. I got too many windows open, dude. Too many windows.
Talk about your father's handling of Iraq a lot.
Mm-hmm. Actually,
his mission.
Yeah, that was actually about 20 pages of it, but that's okay.
You see what a jerk this guy is? This is what a despicable little brat George W. Bush is. So, Mr. President, you talk quite a bit in your book about your father. No, only 20 pages. Well, come on, he said quite a bit. 20 pages is quite a bit. But no, let me interrupt to, you know, deconstruct your question when it's a perfectly fair setup for a question. He's such a petty little boy. He's gonna try to, I'm the boss of this conversation, not you, NPR man. Little jerk.
Impressed you about the mission that your father took this country into?
Well, he had a clear goal, and he wasn't gonna let Saddam Hussein bully allies. He had a strategy to deal with Saddam Hussein, and then when he said this will not stand, he meant it. In other words, he understood that when a president speaks, he's got to mean what he says. And in the book, I lay out that the strategy that I used was in some ways similar to his. We both went to the United Nations to get a resolution. In other words, this wasn't a unilateral American action. We both put together large coalitions of nations. We both gave Saddam Hussein a chance to make a choice. We both cared deeply about the plight of the, you know, citizens in the region. And as I put in the book, the removal of Saddam from Kuwait was the right decision. And the removal of Saddam Hussein from power was the right decision.
Was your mission as clear as your father's?
Yes, I think in many ways it was. It was more complex because this decision was made in a post 9/11 world. In other words, the removal of Saddam from Kuwait was definitely in our national interest, but it didn't necessarily mean that the United States homeland would be threatened or not threatened, depending upon his actions. In our case, the 9/11 attacks changed the strategic equation for the United States, and we had to deal with threats before they fully materialized.
What do you think when people compare the two wars and say that your father's approach was wiser?
I can understand that, and then I ask him to read the book. And
you can't understand that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, sure, I think people, you know, I can understand the comparisons between he and me. I mean, it's a way to do things. I don't agree necessarily that wiser or not wiser, because the situation was different and in many ways more complex.
Because you talk about the current situation in Iraq and the growth of ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at that country today, there are atrocities, there's violence, there's chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Can you argue today that that country is a safer place and a better place than it was when Saddam Hussein was in power?
For the security of the United States, yes. I would argue with you that had the United States once again turned a blind eye to the threat that Saddam Hussein posed, I say once again, there were 17 resolutions by the world demanding accountability, one could envision a nuclear arms race between Iran and Iraq. The man, Saddam Hussein, would have a lot of revenue as a result of high prices of oil. And even though there wasn't, we found a dirty bomb, for example, he had the capacity to make chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. And so there's, it's all very hypothetical. But I could argue that we're much safer without Saddam. And I would argue that the people of Iraq have a better shot at living in a peaceful state.
You'd argue the United States is safer, even though we hear all these very ominous warnings about ISIS, coming in and bringing their fight to U.S. soil.
No question that they're dangerous. And, so was the first iteration of this radicalism when they killed 3,000 people on our soil. And after 9/11, we were very concerned that an enemy of the United States, in this case Saddam Hussein, would be willing to give a network the capacity to destroy on an even greater scale. And, ISIS is dangerous and they need to be dealt with. I would remind you, David, that in 2009 and 2010, the violence in Iraq was settling down. And the democracy, even though it was not perfect, kind of like ours was initially, not perfect, was beginning to work.
Are you saying there are decisions that you would have made that were different than President Obama that might have prevented the chaos that we're seeing
today? Well, one of the things I'm not going to do is second guess our president. On the other hand, as I put in the book, I hope we deal with ISIS firmly.
Just on a broad level.
They don't like the idea of free societies emerging. And this is we're dealing with a network of people who exist where they find safe havens or vacuums or failed states. You might remember the Bush Doctrine, and it was, if you harbor a terrorist, you're equally as guilty as a terrorist. And so there's, in order to secure our country in the post 9/11 world, there has to be certain strategies that are outlined and followed through with. And that's what I.
Broadly, what you tell Americans who look at the chaos today and link it back to your decision to invade in 2003?
I just say the condition elsewhere matters to the security of the United States and we cannot become isolationist.
All right, y'all. So there you go, President George W. Bush. Obviously, a lot to go over there. That's just unbelievable. Are you sitting there just shaking your head at the unbelievability of it all as you listen to this? And I know. I mean, we all lived through 8 years of this guy being in power. But, well, listen, I don't want to go over this stuff because I want to criticize him. I want to go over it because it's all very important subject matter, and there's a lot to learn deconstructing his lies and getting to the truth of things there. So that's what we're going to talk about on the other side of this break. Later on, Trevor Tim and Will Grigg will be both be back on the show. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, you guys. Well, I think I realize I should have kept stopping it and complaining in real time throughout the Bush clip there, maybe. I don't know. It took the whole segment, so at least I didn't have to get broken into two segments. But anyway, at least that means I can go fast through my complaints here, try not to dwell too much on at least some of them. But virtually everything he said there is completely debunkable. This is in chronological order more than order of importance here. But he says that his strategy was similar to his father's in that he went to the UN. Yeah, but the UN would not authorize the start of the war. So he started it anyway. So that's kind of different. And I'm not saying for one second that it makes any sense whatsoever. That's morally right or should be legally right or considered legitimate by any person on this planet. That if the UN Security Council votes to have a war, then they may start one. No one else may start a war, but they may if they agree on the Security Council to do so. That's completely corrupt and bankrupt and ridiculous, and I don't know how the hell anybody ever thought of that. But anyway, that's not what he did. So it's just a damn lie that that's what he did, because that's not what he did. He went and he asked the UN for a resolution, and they told him no. They said, here's half of one. Come back if you want to go to war. They didn't even come back because they didn't have the votes. So they went ahead and started the war anyway, in the name of enforcing UN resolutions. As he later alluded to, Saddam was in violation of 17. I'll say again, there are 17 UN resolutions, and he can't finish his sentence that said he had to disarm all of his weapons of mass destruction that he didn't have. So he finishes his sentence, to hold Iraq accountable. Yeah, that's because you're a liar. You can't finish your sentence any other way but such an obvious lie that you don't dare. So then he just retreats into Clintonian doublespeak, nothingness. Hold him accountable for what? For defying the resolution saying he had to disarm his weapons of mass destruction that he hadn't had since 1991? Oh, okay. And then he cites, yeah, and another thing that I had in common with my dad's strategy is both of us gave Saddam Hussein an ultimatum, and then we acted on that ultimatum. Yeah, and both of you were wearing shoes at the time, too. That's a real similarity there. What? What does that even mean? It doesn't mean anything. It's completely ridiculous. He cites the coalition, but again, in place of the UN resolution, the UN coalition he didn't have, which again would not make it legitimate, just would make it the same, as he's trying to pretend it's the same when it's not, to the NPR liberals, just a measure of his dishonesty more than anything, and a measure of the difference, really, in the consensus on that. The other states, I also think wrongly, but agreed at the UN that Saddam's invasion of Kuwait ought to be reversed. Now, they probably would have preferred that Bush Sr. take yes for an answer and negotiate an Iraqi exit from Kuwait rather than using as an excuse to attack and install bases in Saudi Arabia forever and all of that madness, which provoked, we'll get to that in a second. But they did agree that, hey, Kuwait is a state and a member of the UN, and you're not allowed to do that, Saddam. But America was the Saddam invading Iraq as Kuwait in this one. There's no question about it. That the U.S. was the aggressor. That George Bush was the butcher of Baghdad. Not Saddam Hussein. He was the Kuwaiti king who had every right to have his throne restored. Right? I mean, you know, if our analogies hold between Senior and the son. And then another similarity between him and his father is that both of them cared very much about the Iraqi people. I mean, citizens of the region there. I guess, yeah, there's no such thing as Iraq anymore, so he can't quite say that. Was that the problem there? It's because there's no such thing as Iraq anymore? Was that why he couldn't say it? I don't know. Maybe not. Anyway, but then he does not even attempt to address any honest man, any idiot, in his same position, puberty, any idiot in his same position would have attempted to address the discrepancy in his father's decision to not go ahead and invade all the way to Baghdad and depose Saddam and his decision to, in fact, do that. He doesn't even really do that. The closest he comes is his admission that Iraq was no threat at all. And I quote, "The removal of Saddam from Kuwait was definitely in our national interest, but it didn't necessarily mean that the United States homeland would be threatened or not threatened depending on his actions. In our case, the 9/11 attacks changed the strategic equation for the United States, and we had to deal with threats before they fully materialize. This was how he tricked people into believing that he was accusing Saddam of doing 9/11. This is why so many Americans believe that Iraq did the attack, was that Saddam was friends with Osama. Because he would say, we have to attack Iraq because of September 11th. It sounds like this idiot who can never quite speak English right was trying to say, because they did September 11th, right? Doesn't that sound like what he meant to say? Why do we have to attack Iraq? Because of September 11th. Yeah, he's saying that they attacked us, right? Right? No, he's saying, because we learned that day that from now on, we have to deal with threats before they are threats. Not preemptive war, preventive war. Against threats, Saddam Hussein? But then, of course, the NPR guy doesn't make him justify how Iraq was any threat to America at all. When, as Ron Paul pointed out in 02 and 03, Saddam hadn't been able to shoot down a single one of our airplanes over his country in a dozen years running. And he's tried a few times. But if he's not a threat to his own airspace, how the hell is he a threat to ours? While Tom Ridge has Americans wrapping their houses in duct tape and plastic to keep the germ weapons out from Saddam's drones that he's going to fly across Jordan, Israel, the Mediterranean Sea, maybe take a shortcut across the Iberian Peninsula and then the Atlantic Ocean to spray the eastern seaboard with germ weapons with his balsa wood and string remote control planes. Yeah, that was in the Cincinnati speech, y'all. And anyway, And a lot more talking points than that. Sorry, I lost my train of thought on that. It's just the fake threat that he was preempting. That was the point. Back to my notes. He admits that the same threat that Saddam wasn't in 91, he wasn't in after September 11th. Just September 11th changed the equation to mean it's okay for us to start wars now. As though that wasn't the policy before. And then when he's asked, are the Iraqi people better off now? Unbelievable. He doesn't even say, well, you know, in a lot of ways they are, or anything. The question is asked so vaguely. Are things better now? And so Bush answers, for us they are. F them. What? Well, ever since a couple of weeks into the war and they found no warehouses full of chemical weapons or factories churning the stuff out, none of them were used in the war, they didn't exist, they changed the story. In fact, they changed the story the day of the invasion to Iraqi freedom. We have to stay long enough to build them a democracy so that they can be free. It's all for them. The whole war was one big altruistic, if lamentably failed, experiment in exporting democracy and freedom to the Middle East. Does anybody remember that? As the excuse for staying for 8 years? 8 years! And fighting an entire civil war for the Shia against the Sunni, getting at least upwards of hundreds of thousands of people killed. And his answer is, well, it's better for us. That's good. I can quote you on that, right? Oh, good. I got it in MP3 format here for future reference, too. Thanks. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, I'm Scott. It's my show. I'm talking about George Bush's NPR interview here. He wrote a book about his father, so he's doing a little bit of a book tour here. Hey, you wrote quite a bit about your father's war in Iraq. Nuh-uh, only 20 pages. Okay, whatever, dude. That's not quite a bit at all, I guess. Or, I don't know. Seems not quite a bit. Anyway, so yeah. George Bush, in this war... in this interview, trying to drum up post hoc justifications for his regime change when faced with the question of, yeah, man, but look at ISIS and what a mess and all this war. He says, well, look, you know, Saddam and Iran could have got in a nuclear arms race. Oh, they could have, huh? Yeah. This is the part where he says, yeah, you know, Saddam, he was in violation of 17 resolutions that to hold him to account because, yeah, because he couldn't say American written resolutions demanding that he disarm the weapons that the Americans knew damn well that he had disarmed in 1991 as of 1995 at the latest. And how do I know that? Because Scott Ritter, the UN weapons inspector, says so. And, I mean, I already know the whole story. I saw Hussein Kamel on CNN in 1996. I watched it. Saddam Hussein's son-in-law. I was in charge of destroying it all. It's the same thing I told the CIA and the IAEA and everybody else. Here's everything you need to know. And, anyway, so, yeah, they knew they were lying about all that. And then, so that's all he got. And then he admits himself. I guess the reporter, it's a radio interview, I don't know. But the reporter must have been looking at him funny. It's recorded in Bush's office. You know, not at the radio studio, not over the phone or anything. It's in person. I guess the guy was looking at him funny, so he says, okay, I mean, it's all very hypothetical. Yeah. Yeah, it's all very hypothetical. What possible threat could have possibly emerged where he agrees there was not one, but started a war anyway? It's all very hypothetical. This is his excuse after 11 years of practicing coming up with excuses for this thing. This is the best this man can do. For starting this war. And then he says, and I still think that, you know, this is the best chance the Iraqis have for, peaceful, state. Yeah, like the Islamic State or the Islamic Republic of Iraq. Which one are you referring to? The Islamic Republic of, Iranian sock puppets who, yeah, they have a parliament. See, he doesn't even say, you know, they have a parliament now, right? He doesn't even say anything. Yeah, they have a parliament where no election result is ever respected. Yeah, great job, dude. And then the choice is always still just between which members of the Dawa Party and or Supreme Islamic Council are going to make up the cabinet and kill all the Sunnis. Same as it's been since 2003, especially since 2004 and 5. But anyway. And then... George Bush, in the thing, wait, I gotta fast forward to this, man, and rewind down the script here. They have the whole thing at NPR.org, the transcript. I gotta find, he says, this most important lie, man, that I have to find for you so that I can quote it correctly. Come on, eyeballs, find the thing. No, man, it's not there. Where is it? Maybe it says September 11th instead of 9/11, and that's why I can't find it. Damn it. Somewhere in here, the president claims, I'm going to find the quote here somewhere. The president, George W. Bush, a former president, claims that the first attack was on September 11th. And it's kind of out of context. That's not his only point that he's making. He's trying to use that to make some other point, which is ridiculous. Yeah, this is later on in the interview here. I'm sorry, man. I'm trying to find it in the text here. Oh, yeah. He could have made a dirty bomb. Get the hell out of here. But where is it that he says September 11th was the first attack? But, of course, that wasn't true. Anyway, here's why I think it matters. It doesn't matter in context anyway. It matters in the context I want to put it in. Okay? Ramzi Youssef, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nephew, tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 1993. Al-Qaeda, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and Osama bin Laden associates blew up the Khobar Towers in 1996. They blew up two embassies in Africa in 1998. They blew up the USS Cole in 2000. They tried to do another coal-like attack in Yemen in 99, but the dinghy sank. And they tried to blow up LAX, but they got caught at the border in 2000. And no, September 11th was not the first time that America was ever attacked by Al-Qaeda. But here's why I think he insists on that. It's, first of all, just his own acquittal, right? How could he have possibly expected that attack any more than your mom or dad did? Because none of us had any idea that this could possibly happen. You all saw those planes. They came out of the clear blue sky. And the psychopaths who did it were motivated only by their madness and rage at all things that are good and true and beautiful. So who in the world could predict that? Obviously no one. So it was such a surprise. That is such an important myth of September 11th from the Bush administration. I mean, really, even the official story says that it's American support for Israel that provoked this thing, which is the real truth. But in terms of the very simple story that they kind of sold to the suburbs about what happened here, oh, how we were taken by surprise that day kind of thing. And that's because he doesn't want to get back to, he doesn't want to have to address how his father's policy led to the September 11th attack. His father's occupation of Saudi Arabia for the creation of the permanent war, not the two-month-long cakewalk, the permanent war against Iraq that Bill Clinton then inherited from Bush Sr. and continued to wage for 8 straight years, that Bush Jr. inherited and continued to wage for 2 years before he finally invaded, the lower scale war of routine bombings of the no-fly zones and the blockade and the sanctions and all of that, that had provoked the attack against us in the first place. That's why they were at war with us. And you know how I know? It's because that's what Ramzi Youssef said way back in 1993. He wrote a letter to the New York Times blaming the Serbs. What are you talking about? I did it, and I did it because you pay the Israelis to kill Palestinians, he said. And he went on to cite the war against the people of Iraq. And the same thing is true of, and you know, obviously, for anyone who cares to know about this, they already know. I don't know. Maybe you're young and you never heard it before. I don't know. But you can go read it on the PBS website, okay? I'll stop yelling. I'll say it softly. You can go read it at the PBS website. It's Bin Laden's Declaration of War Against Jews and Crusaders, it's called. There are two different ones. One of them is Against the Jews and Crusaders. The other one is Against the Americans Occupying the Land of the Two Holy Places. Pretty subtle, huh? And if you read them, yeah, he invokes Allah's will all the time and whatever because he's trying to justify himself to the people that he's trying to ally with and trying to get to ally with him. And I guess Scheuer says he really believed that stuff, justify what he was doing. But anyway, if you actually read it, he's not citing just the Quran says kill infidels for not believing like we do. He doesn't say that anywhere in there. All he does is he cites American foreign policies, and specifically support for the Israelis and their criminal occupations against the Lebanese and the Palestinians, unending. For decades on end. I mean, they don't occupy Lebanon anymore, but they did up until 2000. For 20 years, up until 2000. And of course, Palestine continues to be brutally occupied by the Israelis. And he cited the war, the permanent state of war against Iraq from the bases in Saudi Arabia. And they started moving the bases out of Saudi Arabia even before Bush took power. They moved them to Qatar, or started moving them to Qatar. And then Paul Wolfowitz, one of the primary architects of the Iraq War II, famously, because Ron Paul made him famous for it, and I'm pretty sure Ron Paul got the footnote from me, little pat on the back, an article I wrote for antiwar.com, that this is one of the good things about invading Iraq, is now we can get the bases out of Saudi Arabia, which was one of the reasons bin Laden was attacking us, Paul Wolfowitz admitted. Although then that was his conclusion, just move to Iraq. That'll make everything way better. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all. Well, Trevor Tim's Skype is not online. I hate Skype. It sounds better than a landline, but... Oh, there he is. All right, so, yeah, Trevor Tim, he writes for The Guardian. And, oh, hell, where's his bio on this page here? He used to be with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And here it is. He is executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And that's Greenwald and Ellsberg and Snowden and others are on the board of directors of that thing. And he writes, did I mention, for The Guardian. Follow him on Twitter at Trevor Tim, two M's there. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Trevor?
Hey, great. Thanks for having me back.
Good. Very happy to have you on the show here. You've been writing some really good stuff lately, man. We've been running it all at antiwar.com pretty much, I think. I want to start off, though, with something you didn't write, but I know you know all about, at least you do now, and that is this huge news story from the Wall Street Journal, Americans' cell phones targeted in secret U.S. spy program. And before I let you go, I want to mention to the audience, if you ever need to get around the Wall Street Journal paywall, just put the title in Google News, and they'll let you read the whole article there. It's American cell phones targeted in secret U.S. spy programs. So what's the scoop? Please let us in on it.
Sure. So this is actually an amazing story and one I hope gets a lot of attention in the days going forth, because basically what is happening is the federal government is using a tool that we have all known has existed, which is commonly called a stingray, which is essentially a fake cell phone tower that can force your phone and every phone around it to connect to, essentially cutting out of the equation the phone carrier providers. And then they can suck up all sorts of data from your phone from this fake cell phone tower. So, you know, your location, for example, or potentially who you're calling and who's calling you and for how long. And in some cases, even the content of calls. It's unclear if they're doing content here. But what makes this so crazy is that the U.S. Marshals are literally flying planes around what the Wall Street Journal says is a range covering most of the U.S. population, and just having these souped-up stingrays, which are called dirt boxes, they're flying them around these populated areas and sucking up all sorts of cell phone data in an apparent attempt to find suspects. But what's happening is that tens of thousands of innocent people, their cell phone location information is being sucked up along the way. So essentially the government is running a secret mass spying program from the air without any sort of accountability or transparency whatsoever. You know, this was never voted on by anybody. And it is violating people's privacy left and right, and we had no idea.
Man, and so now, I guess the confusion must be all mine here about the Marshal Service. I guess I thought they served the judiciary. Maybe they were under the Justice Department, technically speaking, or something, but they're supposed to be sort of the arm of another branch of government, and I wonder if that's part of a technicality that they're using to be able to get away with this or something.
Yeah, you know, I think that's really interesting part of the story that wasn't fully explored. Like, why are the U.S. Marshals doing this? You know, I think part of the government's explanation or excuse for this is, well, we've been getting court orders for this. We've seen in the past 2 years that the government has actually been misleading judges about the nature of their surveillance. So, for example, when they use these Stingray devices, they don't accurately describe them in the court order. So the judge doesn't actually know what they're approving. They think that they're approving some sort of standard surveillance technique, when instead they're approving this mass surveillance technique, which sucks up, you know, everybody's cell phone information. And actually a few judges have actually kind of fought back against the government about this and gotten really angry that they've been misleading the courts. And so it could be happening in this situation too, where the courts think that they're approving something when they're actually approving something else entirely. So, you know, I hope there's a lot more reporting on this in the days and weeks to come, and we can figure out exactly, you know, why the U.S. Marshals are doing this. And by the way, it's not just U.S. Marshals. This was the focus of the piece, but we know from different records in the past day that, you know, the DEA has this type of technology, the FBI, and likely more agencies than we can even name.
It's funny. It's I don't think I count as naive, really, Trevor, but it seems like they're trying to fill in every gap in our, you know, the regular kind of Americans' idea of what they would never do. I mean, yeah, I guess technically speaking, you could track everybody by their cell phone, but it's not like we live in East Germany or they would really do that. But, oh yeah, no, they keep all our location data apparently for 5 years at least or whatever it is. And yeah, I mean, okay, you could have a spy plane that goes around pretending it's a cell phone tower and intercepting everybody's cell phone and downloading whatever data off of it and whatever, getting right around the safety features because they've got the keys. But I mean, come on, they're not going to do that. I mean, really, but you're telling me, as the Wall Street Journal says here, oh yeah, no, they are all right, and they're covering virtually every bit of ground in America. They are fishing on all of us with this technology. It's madness. This is like an episode of The Outer Limits or something.
It honestly is out of a TV show or movie that they're literally flying planes around the country, vacuuming up as much data as they can from the American public. I mean, I think if you didn't see this, you know, detailed report in the Wall Street Journal, you might not even believe it. You might think it's something out of the movie Enemy of the State or something. But, you know, we've known that this technology has been available to local police for a long time, at least the technology being used on the ground where they can point these devices at a neighborhood or a apartment building or a house and kind of see what type of cell phones are in that, within that area. But to be flying around and just vacuuming it up willy-nilly is really shocking. And I, you know, nobody in Congress has said anything. I mean, it's been less than 24 hours. So, you know, I guess we should at least give them a day, but there should be congressional investigations about this.
Yeah. Well, and of course, I mean, the layers of secrecy here are virtually unlimited. We don't really know yet, do we? Do they talk very much in the article about just how much phishing is going on here? Where, you know, they claim to the judge, I think you're implying that, well, we're looking for, you know, Johnson. And so this is how we're going to find him, is by going out there and looking for his cell phone. But meanwhile, they're scanning everybody else too. Are they also looking for whatever criminal behavior that they can possibly find out of whatever they're vacuuming up from people's phones? Because again, this in the NSA, these are federal cops with jurisdiction over American citizens.
Right. You know, we've been hearing so much about the NSA in the past year and a half, but this is actually much more directly violating people's privacy, and it's being done by domestic law enforcement. You know, this isn't something that we're doing. I mean, it's certainly something we're probably doing in other countries, but this is happening in the United States. And, you know, it's really unclear to your first question about, you know, what's happening to all this innocent all the innocent people who are getting vacuumed up in this surveillance program, you know, what's happening to their location data? Is the agencies that are using this kind of feeding this into an algorithmic system where they're looking for patterns of suspicious behavior, not just suspects that they already have named? And they don't really have answers for that. You know, we don't know exactly what this information, where it's being stored, how long it's being stored, and what they're doing with it. And this is why it's partly so disturbing, is because, you know, this is all being done in secret without us really having a way to check.
Was it Hayden or Alexander that called us all zombies? Everybody with an Android or an iPhone, we're all zombies.
I think it was Hayden, but it could have been Alexander.
Anyway, point being that we're all so stupid. We just hand them everything about us all day long as we cry that they're violating our privacy.
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard to live in 2014 without having a smartphone. You know, people need it for their daily lives, and unfortunately the government has been taking advantage of that without people actually knowing.
Right. Well, and now we know, and yet, as you say, it's a trade-off. I don't know. See, I always suspected all of this from the internet's invention on, so I'm shocked but never surprised. All right, Trevor, Tim, we'll be right back, guys. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Yesterday we had Marcy Wheeler on, the great Empty Wheel, and she talked about how the USA Freedom Act is just some fake reform that in many ways is going to make matters worse and hardly fix anything. But now, that's not the only one. Trevor at TheGuardian.com, Trevor Tim writes, "Watch out, the U.S. government wants to pass new spying laws behind your back. They call it cybersecurity. I say, look out." So tell us all about this. What's this new law and who's pushing it?
Well, this is the law that's been being pushed for a couple years now. Actually, the House has already passed it a couple times. It's either been called CISPA or CISA, C-I-S-A.
That old thing.
Yeah, exactly. Essentially what it is what they call a quote-unquote information sharing bill. But what it does is carve out this giant loophole in privacy laws that allow companies to hand over large quantities of data to the government with in a very nebulous and vague wording, which could allow them essentially to hand over communications without any sort of warrant or court order whatsoever, all under the guise of cybersecurity. And there are, you know, myriad privacy protections that have been proposed, but the bill's authors have rejected them. And luckily, actually, the Obama administration has in the past threatened to veto it because of these all of these people raising privacy concerns. But, you know, Senator Feinstein and Saxby Chambliss have again said in the past week or two that they want to bring this up in the lame duck session. And, you know, they could potentially pass it when nobody's paying attention, and all of a sudden it would become law because, you know, as long as the president signed it, who, you know, probably at this point doesn't want to have this huge veto fight over this bill, considering all of the cybersecurity news we've had lately. So, you know, I think it's a real danger of happening. Whether it does or not is, I think, still remains to be seen. You know, they want to try to pass a lot of stuff in the lame duck session, which they may not get to. But, you know, I thought it was important to bring attention to just so people know it may be coming.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, just because it's been defeated twice doesn't mean they're going to stop trying to do it. And really, it's along the same lines of what Marcy was saying yesterday about, oh, yeah, no, we'll just keep all the data at the private company, or we'll just use the excuse that we're getting it from this third party. And, you know, they had invented this doctrine that somehow if two people have business, then automatically anything that either of them know about each other is not protected by the Fourth Amendment anymore, and the government can have access to all of it. Somehow, I mean, it sounds like I'm overstating it, but am I really overstating the third-party doctrine there?
Well, You know, I don't think so, but I think the real question here
It sounds completely ridiculous. That's why I'm double checking with you. Because, I signed a contract with AT&T that I get phone service from them. Well, obviously, then I have no expectation of privacy whatsoever what any of those records say. Really? Why shouldn't I have an expectation of privacy if that's my contract with them? I only don't have an expectation of privacy because I know that I live in a lawless totalitarian police state where the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply and the government does not respect the restrictions on its power or my rights. That's why I have no expectation. But isn't there some court doctrine that says I shouldn't have to lack the expectation, but for the government's violation of my rights, then it doesn't count? Sorry, I don't know.
I think you're spot on. You know, the government has taken this kind of absurd position that anything that is not the content of your conversations talking to a person in the United States when you're in the United States is fair game for them. So that means any conversation you have overseas to somebody, that means any conversation happening between two people overseas, that means all of the metadata potentially related to your phone call, you know, who calls you, who you call, the time, length, location of your call, all of this is potentially fair game for the government, you know, putting aside the CISPA or CISA law that we're talking about now. And, you know, we see that being kind of manifested in all sorts of ways, including this crazy Stingray dirt box story where they're, you know, flying around an airplane, sucking up all this location data all over the country. And, you know, it's come to the point where their argument has reached absurd levels. And yet, you know, Congress continues to ignore it. And the government continues to try to obfuscate this in courtrooms so that people can't challenge it. And, you know, as these media stories come out one after another, eventually something's going to have to change. And there's going to have to be some at least accountability from one branch of the government so that the American people can at least challenge what's going on.
Right. Yeah, did you ever see that great Onion satire piece where it's like their Sunday morning news show and they're talking about how the CIA's Facebook project is doing really great? They've compiled information on everybody and they could have never done this without getting people to sign up and do it themselves. But now they have access to everything about everyone.
Oh, totally. I mean, you know, Facebook, the Onion was obviously satire, but it was so true. I mean, in many ways, you know, social networks are the greatest gift that intelligence agencies can ask for.
All right. Now, so talk to me about this torture report. Are we ever going to be able to see even the relevant parts of the summary of this thing or what?
I mean, hopefully, you know, I think there's some good news in that. Well, first of all, there's terrible news that somehow it would be hard to imagine that the Intelligence Committee in the Senate could get worse. Given that Senator Feinstein has essentially kept everything secret for the past, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 years. But the Republicans are going to take over the Senate, and the incoming chairman, Richard Burr, has said that he's not going to hold any public hearings on intelligence agencies whatsoever unless somebody's getting confirmed. So we're going to know even less about what the NSA and CIA are doing over the next couple years. But hopefully, Feinstein, whose one, you know, positive attribute is that she has been pushing for the CIA torture report to be released. So she has about 2 months to do it. And the wild card here is Mark Udall. Mark Udall, the senator, the one of two senators with Ron Wyden who have been fighting the hardest for this torture report to be released, just got voted out of office, sadly, but he has an amazing opportunity to read the torture report from the Senate floor, kind of like Senator Gravel. Mike Gravel did in the 1970s with the Pentagon Papers. You know, the Constitution has this speech and debate clause that gives senators immunity. Even when they're reading classified information that would be illegal for anybody else to release, they can read it on the Senate floor and get it out to the public. And, you know, hopefully the pressure is on Mark Udall to kind of become this transparency hero where, you know, he can get this information to the American public, which apparently we can't get any other way because the government just refuses to respond. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I did read one article where he's at least acknowledging your article and that idea and that he's at least considering it, because, of course, he must be since he's heard it. So that's something. I don't know. I mean, he could have all along, but I guess we'll see.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. So I wrote an article last week or right after the election saying that he has a unique opportunity to do this. And people have been asking his office about it. And the Denver Post just reported yesterday that he is definitely considering it. He's leaving all options on the table, and he knows that something's got to happen in the next couple months for the American public to find out about this kind of stuff.
All right. Well, keep up the great work. I sure appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right, y'all. That's the great Trevor Timm. He's writing at The Guardian. He's over at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And look at this one. The U.S. government wants to pass a new spying law behind your back. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, my friend Will Grigg, he's good on everything, dude, including even the Oklahoma City bombing. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Will?
I'm doing very well, Scott. Thank you so much for your kindness.
Very happy to have you back on the show today. Now, I'm sorry, I'm digging through this pile of tabs here. You have no idea how many tabs I got. Oh, wait, I know, we're running it. Oh, no, we're not. We're going to be. Well, anyway, it's at Pro Libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Let me type it in here. Freedom. Here, go ahead, tell them. Who's Jesse Trinidu?
Jesse Trinidu is an attorney from Salt Lake City whose brother, Kenneth Trinidu, was detained by the federal government in San Diego shortly after the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995. He had been visiting his wife's family in Tijuana, Mexico, and he was on parole from a conviction for bank robbery. He was taken to a transfer center in a federal prison outside of Oklahoma City and then beaten to death. About 3 days later, his body was supposedly discovered hanging in its cell. His parents received a phone call explaining that their son had committed suicide in prison and saying that his body was going to be cremated, and his mother, Wilma Trinidu, said, no, you're not going to do that. We're going to have to take custody of the body and give him a proper burial. So Jesse was informed of this, and the two of them obtained the body, and then they scraped off about three layers of pancake makeup and discovered that the body had been traumatized practically to the point where it was unrecognizable. He had been beaten from head to toe. He had been garroted. This is obviously a violent death. But before they received the body, the cell had been sanitized. The bedding had been thrown in. Actually, the bedding had been put in the trunk of a car of an FBI agent where it was putrefying and rendered useless in terms of recovering the evidence. But a few months later, they were able to have the cell inspected by a forensic specialist who found so much evidence of bloodshed within the cell that it was pretty obvious that he had been literally beaten to death. And so Jesse was trying to figure out why his brother was taken to a detention center and then beaten. And he received a phone call in about late 1996, from somebody who said this might have something to do with the case of mistaken identity because your brother looked uncannily like a fellow by the name of Richard Lee Guthrie, who was a neo-Nazi bank robber, and he had been involved in a criminal gang known in the press as the Midwestern Bank Robbery Gang, but they called themselves the Aryan Republican Army. They had been associated with a group that was holed up at a really interesting little commune in eastern Oklahoma called Elohim City. And among the habitués of this little commune were Timothy McVeigh and Andras Strassmeyer, who was a rather enigmatic German national who was involved in military intelligence for their country and for the United States government as well. And there are four or five other people who had been directly implicated in the Oklahoma City bombing plot, gestated there at Elohim City. And Richard Lee Guthrie was an almost physical twin for Jesse Trinidu's late brother Kenneth. They were the same size. They had the same build. They drove the same kind of car. They had similar dragon tattoos. They'd both been arrested for bank robbery. Richard Lee Guthrie was in federal custody at the time that Kenny Trinidu was brought into custody. And what it looks like happened here was that they were trying to tie up a loose end because Guthrie had some critical information about a number of people who were involved in that plot who were assets of the federal government. Practically everybody of significance in Elohim City had some connection to the federal government. Many of them were active informants or assets. There was a woman by the name of Carol Howe, who was the daughter of a very wealthy family in Oklahoma City, who'd gotten sucked into the neo-Nazi underworld. And she'd approached the federal government and wanted to become an asset, an informant for a federal agency. She was working for the ATF. She had scouted, along with a number of other people, a number of potential targets, including the Murrah Federal Building in late 1994, and she was giving detailed and very good intelligence as to the progress of this plot before the bombing. So there were a number of things that were going on at Elohim City that exposed some of the three-letter agencies of the United States government, and apparently what happened is that they scooped up this man who basically at a distance resembled Rich Lee Guthrie closely enough that people thought that they were the same person, and they interrogated him so vigorously that they killed him. And then they tried to cover up the death by making it look like a suicide and rather ineptly trying to get rid of the body. So since that time, since 1996 or 1997, Jesse Trenadue has been trying to find out how exactly his brother got sucked into this vortex. And in doing so, he's been filing Freedom of Information Act requests to dislodge a number of video recordings that have been scooped up by the FBI, one of which in particular apparently would have very clear footage showing the identity, or rather depicting Timothy McVeigh in the company of the much-discussed John Doe number 2, who is a short, swarthy, heavy-set man wearing a baseball cap. His likeness was circulated throughout the country in the days following the Oklahoma City bombing. He's been looking for that specific videotape, and after his family won a large civil judgment from the FBI because of obstruction and destruction of evidence in 2001, Mr. Trenadue put out a $250,000 reward for information that would lead to the identification and arrest and prosecution of John Doe number 2. And the FBI, displaying its usual mix of arrogance and confidence and proprietary obstructionism, has done nothing but hedge up the way and throw up procedural protests and engage in dilatory maneuverings to prevent the disclosure of this videotape, which Mr. Trenadue knows to the point of a moral certainty the FBI had in its possession. And just within the last couple of days, he filed a motion in federal court in Salt Lake City seeking that the FBI be held in contempt for not only its refusal to fulfill his Freedom of Information Act requests, but for witness tampering. Last July, there was a hearing held in Salt Lake City where Mr. Trenadue was going to call to the stand a man by the name of John Matthews, who was an undercover asset for an ongoing, I'm convinced, and so is Jesse Trenadue, an old and ongoing federal program called PATCON, or Patriot Conspiracy. It began in 1990, and PATCON was nothing more or less than an ongoing false flag operation where the FBI, working through a group of people with a military background, went about infiltrating every group that was to the right of Hillary Clinton. And that would include not only, of course, the so-called sovereign citizens and white supremacists and people of that ilk, but libertarian activists and critics of the United Nations. PATCON was directly implicated in Ruby Ridge. It was directly implicated in Waco. From Mr. Trenadue's perspective, it's something that's an ongoing threat. But he was going to have Mr. Matthews on the stand to testify about his knowledge regarding the circumstances surrounding the Oklahoma City bombing, specifically the fact that Mr. McVeigh was in the company of an asset of the FBI, and he was being tracked all the way up to the point where they deposited the Ryder truck and set the bomb to go off. And in the days leading up to the hearing, Mr. Matthews developed cold feet, and he contacted a man referred to as Don Jarrett, although I don't know whether or not that's his name. In the transcript that Mr. Trenadue found of Mr. Matthews talking to FBI Special Agent Adam Quirk in Salt Lake City, the way that Mr. Jarrett was referred to by Mr. Matthews was his name used to be Donald Jarrett. So whether that's his actual name, whether he's using a pseudonym, I don't know. But he said his name used to be Donald Jarrett. Mr. Jarrett, according to his biographical information, was in charge of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in Phoenix And he was involved, obviously, in the Oklahoma City bombing investigation, as were pretty much every other, all the other agents, special agents, field agents of the FBI after the Oklahoma City bombing. They're all sucked into the Oak Bomb investigation, as it was referred to. But he's somebody who's been deeply involved in all these operations having to do with the PATCON initiative and with investigating the radical right. And what Mr. Jarrett told Mr. Matthews once again was an asset of PATCON. He'd been used to infiltrate these right-wing groups. He said that it might be a good idea if you either avoid being called to testify, if you're subpoenaed to testify, just go into court and perjure yourself. Just say you can't remember anything.
All right, wait. So, now, hold it right there, Will. We've got to take this break. When we get back, more about the heroic Jesse Trinidu and his court battle with the FBI with the great Will Gregg, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. So I completely botched his introduction. It's my friend, the heroic William Norman Gregg, Will Gregg. Follow him on Twitter, Blarney Con Carney. His website is called Pro Libertate. It's at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Just Google Will Gregg. There's a famous soccer player, and then there's my man. All right. Oh, also in his son. But that's it. There's only three Will Griggs in the world. All right. Now, so the article is this. They'll be back. PATCON, Oklahoma City, and Jesse Trinidu's Lonely Crusade for Justice. So Will Gregg told the story in the first segment. Longest story short, one of McVeigh's, the Oklahoma bomber's John Doe's, was a guy named Guthrie, and apparently a very innocent man who had nothing to do with anything named Kenneth Trinidu was mistaken for him and then beaten to death. But unfortunately for the federal pigs, his brother is a lawyer and a great guy and has stopped at nothing now for more than a decade to fight for justice for his brother. And then his story has, of course, then unwittingly led Jesse, the lawyer brother, to the story of the Oklahoma City bombing and the help that McVeigh had, which, as Will Gregg was explaining there, included a lot of flip state's witnesses and undercover FBI informants, et cetera, et cetera, which brings us to the current case where he's suing for the videos, Jesse is, for the videos that he knows exist of McVeigh and his immediate accomplice to the bombing, who was riding in the truck with him that day, getting out of the truck, and the FBI is claiming that they don't have the video. And then as part of this suit, as Will Gregg explained, Jesse Trinidu is trying to call this former FBI agent, officer, asset, something to the stand. But then this is where the current case comes down to the current FBI tampering this witness, tampering with him, and telling him, do whatever you can to not go up there and testify in federal court, which I think, Will, is that not a crime, obstruction of justice and jury tampering and that kind of thing? If laws applied to federal agents, couldn't they go to jail for something like that?
It certainly would be if the laws were applied with equity. And if you don't cooperate with the FBI, or if you're stupid enough to speak with them without recording the interview and they take down a 302, which is the transcript of the interview, and the transcriptionist decides that you've said something that you didn't say in substance, then that discrepancy could be used to prosecute you for a perjury or for obstruction. And so what you have here, obviously, is one of those manifold instances where the government is exempt from the laws that it imposes upon the rest of us. In the case of John Matthews, you've got somebody who obviously knows a great deal of the inner mechanics of this whole PATCON operation, which, as I said, and both Jesse Trentadue and myself, we're both convinced that this is an ongoing initiative. Certainly it's morphed into our more standard Homeland Security theater operation, the template that's been used against Muslims and others that actually started with the radical right, and I suspect that they're going to be shifting back to the so-called sovereign citizens now as the FBI is looking for new ways to engineer phony plots that it can triumphantly bust. That's what they've been doing now for decades. But John Matthews had approached his handler, this Donald Jarrett fellow, Donald Jarrett or Donald Jarrett, I don't know how the name would be pronounced. He's supposedly working as an independent insurance professional in Florida right now, which is not something that his vita would suggest he would end up doing, because this is a guy who started out military intelligence before going into the FBI, that was deeply involved in all of these undercover operations targeting the radical right in the 1990s. But he approached his handler and asked, what should I do? His handler said, avoid the subpoena. If it's necessary, take a trip. If you end up being served and you have to go testify, just sit on the stand and lie, say you don't recall anything. And at the advice of his handler, he approached Adam Quirk. Adam Quirk is the special agent in charge of the office there in Salt Lake City, and Adam Quirk essentially said the same thing. And as a matter of fact, when Mr. Matthews said, I might take a trip, what Adam said, well, that's just fine. And then using a vulgar Anglo-Saxon expression for illicit carnal intercourse, said, blank them, meaning the them in question would be Jesse Trentadue, meaning somebody who has been working with the federal courts and has been victorious so far, is an unbroken string of victories in federal court. He has a right to receive, through the Freedom of Information Act, the documents he has requested. He has a right to receive the testimony of Mr. Matthews and what the FBI is saying. Well, it just sucks to be you. You know, we are not vulnerable. We are not under the jurisdiction of the courts when it comes to concealing our actions that may indeed, in this case, definitely did lead to the death of scores or hundreds of innocent people.
Well, now, but so how come they can't just subpoena him then? Why is it just an invitation to
please? I don't know why they've not issued a subpoena. I think what they're trying to do is deal with somebody who's very much the sort of person for whom a subpoena would be considered optional. He could just go to ground, and his handlers and the FBI would be able to spirit him away any place he needs to go in order to avoid giving testimony. I think that Jesse's approach here is to say, why don't we work with him cooperatively and make it clear that we're not antagonists. You're dealing with somebody who's fragile and dying. He's in a bad state of affairs right now in terms of his health. I think he's dealing with the aftermath of Agent Orange. He's a Vietnam-era veteran, as were most of the people that were brought into PATCON. The FBI used their patriotic impulses against them. They said, you know, we have to be fighting a new war here within the homeland. They didn't use the expression homeland in the 1990s, probably, but, you know, we're dealing with a domestic enemy here, and we need your help in order to ferret these people out and expose them. That's the sort of cynical thing that the FBI has been very good at doing for decades now, is to pervert patriotic impulses and use them as weapons against people who are susceptible to that type of an appeal. But to answer your question, Scott, I suspect that they're taking a soft-handed approach to somebody that they're trying to coax into the courtroom. And I think that what they've discovered here is that they can't be soft-handed enough in order to outbid the FBI when it comes to blandishments or in order to overcome the implicit threat that is contained in everything the FBI says to you when they approach you as either a witness or an asset.
Well, but then again, the FBI has a real problem in this Judge Clark Wadups, correct?
Yes. Quite in defiance of one's rational expectations of how a federal jurist would act, he's been very even-handed. He's been applying the law. And what Jesse is trying to do here is to have a special master appointed who would be a judicial official that would have some sort of a custodial role in making sure that the FBI doesn't destroy evidence again, because they've been found guilty of that. That happened in 2001, that Jesse and his family were able to get a very large civil judgment against the FBI because they had been destroying evidence in the Oklahoma City bombing case. And what they have been saying about the location of this videotape is that apparently it ended up in the same vast, intractable warehouse where the Ark of the Covenant is stored, because they said that there's so much evidence they collected in the Oak Bomb investigation, they simply can't find it, which, of course, is nonsense on stilts. Granted, we're dealing with a government agency. Government agencies are incompetent, whether or not actively corrupt. And it's always dangerous to impute to deliberate deviousness, which you can easily explain through simple corruption and ineptitude.
Right.
But this is an organization that was started, of course, by the person who invented the whole idea of file keeping and information storage and retrieval. And so they do have a certain competence when it comes to finding stuff that they need, particularly if they're going to use it against somebody. When they're being asked to provide evidence that will inculpate themselves, of course, they suddenly develop an otherwise unwanted incapacity for finding what you're looking for, but they know exactly where it is.
Well, now Jesse is suing for access to the warehouse. Let me in there. I'll go find it in the ARC,
exactly.
Too.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what he's trying to do. And all along the way, the federal government's been saying, well, we can't let you look at this stuff because it would compromise the identities of undercover operatives, which is why he and I and a number of other people are convinced that the reason they're being so protective, they're being so prehensile here, is because these people are still out there causing trouble. I think that Mr. Jarrett is not an insurance professional. He was in Afghanistan yet last year. I don't think he was over there doing claims adjusting work. So what is he doing, and with whom is he doing it? Well, he's out there, probably, in my opinion, working with the old gang from PatCon. And bear in mind, Scott, what's going to happen over the next few days in Ferguson, Missouri, and the fact that there are potential racial fissures that could be pried open very easily here to the profit of people who love to keep us at daggers drawn with each other, the old divide-and-conquer game. Suddenly we have this relatively obscure and not particularly well-organized or prominent Klan faction that shows up playing the old Revolution USA game where they're taking the side of the police in Ferguson and saying that they're going to be on the streets willing to use armed lethal force against rioters on behalf of law and order.
Yeah, I wonder how many of those guys are FBI informants.
I'm sorry, what?
I wonder how many of those guys are FBI informants.
I see you could probably round it up to everybody in that group, because without the active involvement of the federal government, most of these so-called radical right groups, these white supremacist groups, they'd disappear entirely. That was the case back in the 1960s. The received folk wisdom was that if you're part of a right-wing white supremacist group, then the guy who shows up who's actually got money and connections, he's the Fed. And that's what they've been doing for the last 40 or 50 years, is keeping these groups on life support for times like this.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, too, because I think all decent people would expect the FBI to infiltrate Klan groups and groups like that in order to make sure that they're not doing anything horrible, in order to prevent crimes, not to go in there and provoke them and, as you say, finance them, keep them on life support, keep them going and make them worse, get people killed.
Yeah, it's the same. It's exactly the same template they've used with Muslim groups in this country, where they've sketched out these elaborate plots and that they have gotten people implicated in them to the point where they come right up to the consummation of this terrorist plot. And then the FBI intervenes to arrest everybody and to receive the hosannas of the stenographer press. The difference with the Oklahoma City bombing, Mr. Tredadue is convinced, is that the sting was stung or the trap misfired. He honestly believes that this is the sort of thing that was supposed to come right up to the point of consummation and then be stopped just before the bomb went off. And from his reading, and I think his reading is very plausible, their chief motivation right now, apart from keeping the people who are involved in this sort of thing secret, is simple personal institutional self-preservation. Because if you can make a good case that there's diligence of that order of magnitude involved in what had been the largest terrorist attack in American history up to that point, yeah. You know, there are some people who not only will lose their careers, but there's some people who are going to end up spending the rest of their lives looking at striped sunlight. And so I think that you've got, first of all, Larry Potts. He was very deeply involved in Ruby Ridge and Waco, writing the rules of engagement that led to murder at Ruby Ridge and, of course, mass murder at Waco. According to the affidavit that Mr. Tredadue got from Nichols, the one co-conspirator that the federal government's willing to admit was a co-conspirator here, is that Larry Potts was the fellow who was calling the shots on behalf of the FBI. And, of course, the fellow in the Justice Department who would be supervising this is none other than Eric Holder. And Mr. Holder is nigh upon retirement, and he's going to go off to some very richly compensated corporate sinecure or something in the banking industry and be up giving speeches for honorariums that would probably have four or five zeros or more after them for every appearance. But, you know, these are people who've left a trail of blood. And Tredadue right now is the only person who's pursuing that trail. And Clark Wadups, for some reason, in Salt Lake City, is a federal judge who's willing to apply the law even-handedly. And so what they're confronting right now is the adamantine resistance and obstructionism of the FBI. And in doing so, every time he goes to court, he ends up dislodging something significant. The fact that the FBI was actively tampering with a witness this July, and you've got the names of the agents involved in that, that's something the public wouldn't have known were it not for his persistence.
Right. And it just goes to show, too, how interested they are in continuing to keep a lid on this thing. Even
absolutely
though realistically,
frantic.
They got away with it for 20 years now. Who's going to go to prison? Larry Potts? None of these guys are going to get in trouble for anything. 2 weeks paid vacation would be the worst they could possibly face.
But one can dream.
Yeah. But, yeah, no, I sure would like the truth to come out because I think there's a lot to learn from the fact that they were able to get away with pinning such a massive crime on one guy. And you know, hell, we're over time in recording, so maybe you got to go. But I was going to ask you about one more thing was about
sure.
if you read the Gumbel Roger Charles book, where they have, I believe, they have the quotes from the Justice Department officials talking about, well, you know, the choice was whether to just focus on McVeigh or whether to try to go after everybody. And
yeah.
And there was a big fight in the office, and the Just Focus on McVeigh faction won. Like, that's how they boiled down the explanation mm-hmm. to this massive cover-up, is that,
yeah.
well, you know, some of us just wanted to focus on the one guy, and others of us disagreed, but, you know, the boss sided with the other side or whatever. And anyway, I just thought that that was, I don't know if I have a question there, but I actually could see that in real life playing out
sure.
a lot like that, too.
That's how committee meetings usually function, is that one side takes the initiative and the side that usually wins is the one that is making an argument that most resonates with the obvious self-interest of the people in the room. And it was obviously in their immediate personal interest that they find somebody to be like the white whale from Moby Dick, you know, somebody upon whose white hump you could pile the sum of all the sins and the crimes and corruption and say, okay, there, we're going to sacrifice this person. And in doing so, the public will be placated and our careers will be protected. And that makes a whole lot more sense than the idea that people are assembling in a hollow volcano like the syndicate from, I believe it was called the syndicate from the X-Files. You know, usually a conspiracy is more a matter of corrupt opportunism rather than diligent, detailed planning. And I think that's what we're seeing right now. But the institutional self-interest of the FBI here seems to be driving what's going on with respect to Trenadue's legal campaign here. And that shouldn't surprise us. But what leaves me somewhat haunted, as I suggest in this essay, is that these people are out there. They've not been punished. They're still active. They're still being protected. And we've got every reason to suspect that we're going to be hearing from these people again. And that's what really caused the sleep to depart for me.
Right. Well, you know, at least as far as getting the truth out goes, at least we have the fact of Jesse Trenadue and what a tough guy he is, that he has
oh, yeah.
stuck with this all this time,
yeah.
taking on the entire Justice Department himself like this. All
yeah,
right, so anyway, I'll let you go. Thanks so much for your time and for writing about this and all that, as always, Will.
Okay, you take care, Scott. It's great to hear from you.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right, y'all, that's the great Will Grigg, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com for his great blog, Pro Libertate. And hit that PayPal button and help support over there, too. It's this article is They'll Be Back, Pat Conn, Oklahoma City, and Jesse Trenadue's Lonely Crusade for Justice. That's Will Grigg, and we'll be back tomorrow. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.